Our next case is number 18-14980, MSPA Claims 1 LLC versus Kingsway Amigo Insurance Company. Mr. Zincone.
Good morning. May it please the court. Francesco Zincone here on behalf of the appellant, plaintiff below, MSPA Claims 1 LLC. The question before this court will have a significant impact on Medicare recoveries under the MSP Act. The appellee, together with the private no-fault and liability insurance communities, here seek to take the administrative burden of Medicare reimbursement off of their shoulders and shift it to Medicare. The construction of the statute, which was adopted by the court in the proceeding below, is squarely at odds with the overarching and overriding principle of the MSP Act, together with the well-documented purpose of the claims filing provision itself.
Tell me if you, and then you can get into your statutory argument, but if you are right about which clause governs, why are you timely, at least insofar as the complaint is concerned? Why did you file within that 3-year window specified in BIII?
The time period specified in sub B3 is expressly identified as the statute of limitations with respect to the government's right of action. And here we've applied it with respect to the private cause of action under 1395YB3A. The reason that this case is timely is because the period or the claims filing provision is not, in fact, a limitations period. It wasn't imposed as a limitation upon Congress at its own volition for the benefit of the private insurance.
No, I know. You're right. I want to know if you are correct about which clause governs, why, according to the complaint, was your claim or your lawsuit timely?
As alleged in the complaint and as reflected in B3, the trigger for the government's cause of action is notice. Notice provided under Section 1395YB8, which places an affirmative obligation on no-fault insurers to investigate a Medicare beneficiary's entitlement under the program, and then upon making that investigation, if it is determined, to report that information directly to Medicare. We allege in the complaint plainly that was not done here. There was no notice ever given to plaintiff's assigner, Florida Healthcare Plus, and as a result, there would be no basis to bar the claim that's been brought in the proceedings below.
When did you get notice from any source, according to the complaint?
According to the complaint, notice did not come until November of 2015, when, based upon our own review of records, we were able to identify that this accident had occurred and the potential for a Medicare Secondary Payer Act recovery. It was only then that a letter was sent to Kingsway Amigo Insurance Company, and in response, we received multiple responses, one of which was an identification of the settlement agreement, which plainly demonstrated the responsibility of the defendant in the case.
And that took place when? In 18?
In November of 2015.
And then you filed
November of 15.
And filed subsequently in December of 2015.
So let me ask you this. How did MSPA find out about Kingsland here? You know, you say you only really got notice in November through your own efforts. How did you find out about them? And could you have found out about them earlier, about the accident earlier?
Well, the question then has really two parts here. And it has multiple levels as to whether or not we could have and whether or not the statute contemplates that we must in order to bring a cause of action. With respect to the first question, it was a matter of the plaintiff here, MSPA Claims 1 LLC, going back through and requesting accident records and a complete and creating a system where it could review a body of data that had not previously been synthesized and made available to MAOs, and which really was not previously possible. Upon reviewing that information, the potential for the Medicare secondary payer situation was found, and the demand was sent. If we look at the actual statutory provisions under which we're operating, it's very clear that the payment which was originally made on behalf of a Medicare beneficiary between April and July of 2012 for the items and services related was immediately conditional upon being made. It was by operation of 2B1, 2BI, a conditional payment subject to reimbursement, and that reimbursement was required by virtue of the settlement agreement entered much later. The statute places no affirmative obligation upon the MAO to go out and conduct this investigation. In fact, it's just the opposite. Throughout, we see that there are a number of provisions that work together. Most notably, 2BII states that upon demonstration of responsibility by virtue of a judgment or settlement, payment, or other award, or for other reasons that have been made available or that have now become apparent to the primary plan, they have an obligation, an absolute obligation, to reimburse to the proper Medicare trust. It says likewise under B8 that it shall conduct this investigation and that it shall report. So the statutory framework is one intended to take the burden off of Medicare, where it had rested for so long before, and to place it on to where it could properly be absorbed, as this court noted in Baxter, to the private insurance industry, to allow them, to let them investigate. Because quite frankly, just as noted in Western Heritage, in April or in March of 2013, when Kingsway Amigo entered into the settlement that's at issue here, they had every opportunity to make a simple inquiry to the Medicare beneficiary as to its Medicare status and as to whether or not she had an MAO and whether or not payments had been made. It elected to remain in the backdrop, as we've said.
So your point with respect to whether, sort of when you found out about, I keep calling them Kingsland, but Kingsway.
Kingsway. Yes.
But when you found out about them and whether you had an obligation to investigate is, with this sort of switch that occurred to take the burden off of Medicare, put it on the private insurance industry, make Medicare sort of secondary to the primary insurer, that's why that policy is what dictates sort of the actual notice provision in the government cause of action statute of limitations that you say you sort of partake of, right? So it's actual notice, not sort of like should have known.
Correct. It's actual notice, and it's very clear. It's very the statute in that respect is unambiguous. It says under BIII, it states that this is from it must be filed within 3 years of notice, as provided under paragraph 8. Receipt of notice under paragraph 8. In the event, what we have alleged clearly in this case is that there was never receipt of notice under paragraph 8, and as a result, our claim was timely. And this is a reasonable way of reading the claims filing. What we have under
you, two. You, to go back to Judge Newsom's question a moment with a little bit of a wrinkle.
Mm-hmm.
To trigger the 3 year, if you are right about which provision governs, to trigger the limitations period, does the notice have to be from the insurance company? In other words, if someone walks into your office and says, hey, this just happened, and gives you all the documents, but you haven't heard from the person you believe should be responsible for the Medicare secondary payment, do you have receipt of notice under the statute?
Under the statute, it's an interesting hypothetical, but the statute in that respect has again been structured to protect Medicare. It is very clear in that.
But that provision is silent about
other notice.
From where the notice has to come from. It says filed not mm-hmm. later than 3 years after the date of the receipt of notice of a settlement, judgment, award, or other payment.
And
it doesn't say where the notice comes from.
It does. It continues pursuant to paragraph 8. Pursuant to paragraph 8. And paragraph 8 constructs exactly the type of, or imposes an affirmative obligation of the type of notice that's being referenced.
So if they never provide you notice, you could file suit 30 years from now if they're still around.
Based upon a reading of the complaint.
Right. Even if you know that X happened and you're like, for litigation reasons, we're going to wait 5 years, 7 years, 10 years.
Perhaps under those circumstances.
You could do that.
Perhaps under those circumstances, there would be other arguments that would mitigate against it. But under a
sure, you might have, I guess if you have a common law latches argument, maybe if that could somehow be read into the statute. But statutorily, you would not be time barred.
Statutorily, no. That's not from the time from when the statute of limitations begins to run on the private cause of action or on the government's cause of action is clear and unambiguous from the receipt pursuant to paragraph 8.
Okay.
Is there any evidence here to suggest that you had notice from any source before November of 2015?
Again, this is a judgment on the pleadings. There's no evidence of anything yet in the record. This is something that's been, this was decided by Judge King on the basis, on the face of the complaint, finding that there was no material dispute as to notice or as to the application of this particular claims filing provision.
Right, that's one of the things that the magistrate judge thought inured in your favor, which was this was not summary judgment. This was a motion for judgment on the pleadings where you have to take the complaint as true and draw all reasonable inferences in your client's favor. And so his fallback position was, at the very least, this goes on to the next stage of litigation where you get discovery to find out when there was receipt of notice, if at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And to go back to your last question, because I recognize that perhaps this view of the statute of limitations may seem overly punitive, but it really it's.
You may be right. Some statutes are just written in a way that it leads to result X, even if someone on the street might think, "Ooh, that's a weird result." So,
and it's because the overriding purpose is very clear that it places the absolute burden of paying for items and services whenever possible on a private insurer. So, really, the situation should never arise because it is entirely within the settling party's control to avoid the type of circumstances that we have here and to make sure that there is certainty with respect to the application of that statute of limitations by complying with the very basic notice requirements that are outlined at paragraph 8.
Okay, Mr. Chincone, thank you so much. You reserve your time for rebuttal. Mr. Burdell.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court.
So not to throw you, but can I ask you a question?
Yes.
We might be able just to clear away some
underbrush, Your Honor,
at the outset. So to Judge Jordan's question to your adversary, let's just begin there. Do you have any basis for disputing that if the claims filing provision is not a standalone bar, and what we're concerned about here is just the statute of limitations that he says is borrowed from the government provision, the 3-year notice-based statute of limitations, that their filing is timely? Is that agreed on this record?
It's not necessarily agreed on this record, Your Honor. I would not.
Do you have an argument separate and apart?
I have a separate,
claims?
And that's the interesting thing here. Counsel, my opponent in the district court and here wants to push the argument away from the plain and unambiguous reading of Clause 6. And
well, so hold on.
Have Your Honors consider.
Are you talking
clause
about when
3.
You talk about Clause 6? Are you talking about what I'm calling the claims filing provision?
That's Clause 6.
All right, so yes, so that I understand. Your argument is that that's a standalone basis precondition to recovery, right?
It's a claims filing,
okay,
period. It doesn't have to be a condition precedent.
But just so I'm clear, if we get beyond that, as to just a statute of limitations-based argument, I don't see that you've made one.
I have not made a statute of limitations
good.
Argument.
Then we're just talking about
and it
claims.
May or may not be timely under the statute of limitations.
Okay, but for our purposes here, we're just talking about the claims filing provision and whether that's a standalone precondition to suit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Got it. Okay, good.
If I may, the because counsel has raised Clause 3, a statute of limitations, I haven't argued a statute of limitations. That's not why we're here. And Your Honor's also made a telling argument that if we were to address Clause 3, what is the period of time that a claim has to be actually filed? That's not how the statute was written, setting aside Clause 3. If I may go back, and if I could just lay a little bit of a predicate in responding to counsel before I get into my main argument, First of all, this is not the government that's making this argument. It's not an MAO making this argument. These are purported assinees of MAOs. And the Medicare secondary payer statute was laid out, as I'm going to go through, giving the government a duty to investigate and act promptly. I'm going to go through all the provisions. But what we're hearing is that the government or somebody standing in the shoes of an MAO, perhaps, can sit on their hands forever and lay in the weeds.
So I understand important to your argument is the fact that the statutory scheme was designed to favor the government, right? And they're not the government, right?
No, that's not my argument, Your Honor. The statutory scheme was certainly to favor the government, but there's an even-handed way in which the statute was presented by Congress, especially with the addition of Clause 6, which means that the government must act promptly and expeditiously to investigate. And let me go back, although this is judgment on the pleadings, and we're really not supposed to look to extraneous evidence, Your Honor's asked a real pointed question. Did they have reason to know from the outset that Kingsway Amigo was an automobile liability insurer that might have obligations related to this case? The answer to that question is yes. The converse is not true. Kingsway Amigo had no reason to know. Let me tell you why. The police report.
But those are all merits-based.
They
issues.
Are. But Your Honor's asked whether. And by the way, Clause 6 is not based on notice. The other side reads a notice provision in Clause 6 that's not there. Clearly, it says that the government must request payment within 3 years from the date of rendering of the item or service.
Is that what it says? Where's the word must? Where's the word must in Clause 6? As I read it, it says, notwithstanding any other time limits that may exist for filing a claim under an employer group health plan, the United States may.
Well, you're right, Your Honor.
The must?
No, there's not a must. I apologize.
No, I don't think you're trying to trick me. I actually think that this is like, this is the core of your position.
This is you the think core, that, and this is the core
that
of the argument.
Sub 6 is, in fact, a mandatory provision,
it is.
And I just don't read it that way.
Well, that's how, this is an important point, Judge Newsom. Judge King addressed this issue. Senior District Judge King, who I eminently might add, this building is named after, he addressed the question of, is this a permissive statute? And he said, no, that would read out the requirement altogether. The reason the word may is there is that the government may or they may not. There's a waiver provision in the Medicare Secondary Payer Statute. Again, it requires the government to act promptly and expeditiously. And I might add, when the other side says that all the burdens are on primary payers, that's not true. There's even these statutes, like most statutes, are written even-handedly. There's even-handed burdens and obligations. But Judge King, to address your point, Judge Newsom said, no, if we were to read it as permissive, that means that the government may or may not request payment within 3 years, or they may request payment in 4 years, or they may request payment in 40 years.
I said, look, this, you know, some employer benefit plans impose certain limits, and without respect to those employer benefit plans, this sub 6 allows the government to circumvent them, in essence.
So what your point is addressing is that this issue came up in the case of U.S. versus Shalala, and the government took the position that we do not have to respect any time limitation periods of any plan. And the Shalala court said, that's clearly not, that they invalidated that. That's clearly not permissible. And what happened was, so that was in 1994, that was in 1994. And in 1997, in the Balanced Budget Act, Congress added Clause 6 in response to Shalala and determined that the government doesn't have to give regard to any limitation in a plan. However, the government Clause 6 may seek to recover.
Does the government have to request payment administratively before it files suit? Assume it's not a private entity like MSP. Does the government have to seek administrative remedies before it files suit under 6?
I'm not sure that it's an it's a claims filing period. So unlike a statute of limitations,
does it have to yes, file a claim?
I would say,
or can it just sue?
So the words file a claim is sort of loose nomenclature. What it means is that submit a claim for payment. That's what's intended. And the legislative history bears this out. What this means is that government, within 3 years, whether we use may or must or what have you, has to seek a recovery of those payments within 3 years,
but
without exception, according to legislative history.
Just, I want to make sure we're being precise with the language. Yes. What you just said is, whether we use may or must, the government has to. That's must.
Well, I would commend to you, Your Honors, the legislative history cited in the brief. Let me find it, Your Honor. The legislative history, Your Honor, it plainly sets forth the purpose of the provision, and that is that this is something the government must follow. There's that word must. Here it is, Your Honor, forgive me. From the congressional report in June 24, 1997, the proposal would improve accounting for secondary payer situations by permitting Medicare to notify primary insurers of erroneous payments for up to 3 years after a claim is filed. What that means is after a claim is filed, meaning after. So in the first instance, a patient goes to a hospital, for example, and the hospital renders the care. In this instance, this particular individual went to Jackson Memorial Hospital issued a lien notice upon Kingsway Amigo with the person's name, but it didn't mention her age. And the police report, mentions this person, mentions Kingsway Amigo on the police report. What happened here is that the named insured on the Kingsway Amigo policy gave his vehicle to another gentleman to sell it, not to drive it. But he drove it, and he committed a hit and run. So he ran from the scene, this person who was driving the vehicle, wasn't supposed to drive it. There's a coverage issue here. But he ran from the scene. The police reporter making notations, notes Kingsway Amigo Insurance Company, probably an insurance card in the glove box, if you will. It mentions this particular, there are three individuals in the vehicle that were injured. This person was one of them, doesn't give a birth date. So the MAO for whom this company, MSP, purportedly stands in the shoes, had reason to know. From the beginning, if you get the police report, contact Jackson Memorial Hospital. MAO's paying that bill. They have reason to know from the beginning to pursue this claim. And they have 3 years to do that. If I might read the legislative history further. Go ahead.
So let me just ask you this. So sub 6 applies by its terms to the government, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so forget about the fact that we have a private MAO involved. What sense would it make for the entire statutory scheme to be such that, with respect to the government, you've got this hard and fast rule that requires a reimbursement request within 3 years, hard and fast rule within 3 years of services without respect to notice, and then separately, a statute of limitations that's tied much more flexibly to notice? That just makes no sense to me.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, that's a great question, and I'm responding to that. Let me just add one last legislative history and then answer that question. The Balanced Budget Act clarifies that recoveries can be initiated up to 3 years after the date of service was furnished. To address your question, Your Honor, it's important to know that the statute of limitations in Clause 3 was added later. Many years later, in 2013, as part of the SMART Act, Clause 6 was part of the statute added in the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. It set forth a claims limitation period. So the government must, within the 3 years, request payment, and if they complied with that, and another party may or may not responsible, who they submitted that request for payment to, if they're not responsible, then they won't make the payment. If they are responsible by later entering into a settlement, and by the way, this is not a PIP matter. This is a commercial auto policy case. But if they later settle, the government's fulfilled its obligation by submitting its request for payment within the 3 years. They've followed the claim limitation period and not allowed it to become stale. And then when there is demonstrated responsibility, according to the Allstate case in this court, demonstrated responsibility by a settlement or judgment or other means, then that's how you establish responsibility against a primary payer. And given the later statute of limitations added in 2013, which Your Honor made it rather open-ended, which is that the government has 3 years from the date of notice, whatever that means, to file an action.
All right, so I've got two questions, one textual, one practical. The textual question is this. The sub six doesn't just contemplate sort of this shotgun approach of like requests for reimbursement to anyone who might plausibly be out there. It seems to contemplate notices to those who are required or responsible. So it seems to contemplate like some
sense, subset.
Some sense that the person to whom the request is made is in fact responsible. Not just like might plausibly be an insurance company.
No.
But is in fact responsible. And then practically, I mean, would you want to incentivize this sort of like prophylactic requests for reimbursement to like everybody who might be plausibly in the universe?
So practically, Your Honor, no. What you want to do is incentivize the government from the beginning to move and act expeditiously as the statute is worded and written to determine who, for example, in this specific case, Jackson, the MAO, once they pay that bill in 2012, shortly after the day of the accident, MAO pays the bill to Jackson Memorial Hospital, they have under the statute, under Clause 6, they have a duty to investigate promptly.
All right, let me take you through the same set of questions with the government in the place of MSP. Okay, same timeline as we had here. Okay, by when does the government have to satisfy subsection 6?
It specifically says.
No, I'm asking you for a date. Like,
oh,
the government in this case had to satisfy.
Within 3 years from date of service, and specifically in this case.
No, it's not date of service, date of which the item or service was furnished.
Right.
Right, okay, so what was the date by which the government had to satisfy subsection 6?
The last date would have been June of 2015. The individual at issue here was involved in the auto accident on April 26, 2012, and she incurred medical bills through June of 2012.
Okay, by
that
when did the government have...
years, June of 2015, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. By when did the government have to satisfy subsection 3?
So that, Your Honor, our argument is that these... Although we're not arguing a statute of limitations, we're arguing
that... Well, first of all, Judge King called it a limitation provision, whatever he thought that meant, but he called it limitation provision a number of times.
It is.
He didn't call it... You say you're not arguing it's a limitation provision.
No, not a statute of limitations.
What is it?
It's a claims filing period.
Okay.
And the two can be read together, Your Honor. That's our argument.
Okay, so when
the other side has an obligation... Go ahead.
When did the government have to act to satisfy... with the same timeline we have here, subsection 3?
Although that's not our argument on subsection 3, I would argue that they
No, because I want to know how they worked together.
Assuming it was the government,
yes,
constructive notice when they paid that bill.
By when did they have to file a claim in a lawsuit? What was the last date they could file a lawsuit?
Would have been, if it was constructive notice, Your Honor, would
you
have
use whatever notice you want.
It could be whenever they learned. But if it's not constructive notice, if it's when there's a settlement or judgment, it's 3 years from that date. I'm not arguing that this cause of action is not timely under a statute of limitations.
So at the point in time that the government makes a payment, it therefore has constructive notice that someone else should be on the hook. And then the three-year period for three begins to run on that date.
I'm arguing, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm arguing they have constructive notice as to Clause 6. To submit a request for payment, and by the way, the regulations support this. The regulations 422.24 says the government may collect by billing. And then as to MAOs, who they purportedly stand in the shoes of 422.108 B and D, it says the MAO may bill.
I want to ask about statutory construction, if you don't mind. Are you through?
No, go ahead. Go right ahead.
You seem to know a lot about the history of this statute, which is a mess, in my opinion. We wouldn't be here.
Yes, Your Honor.
You explained that we need to look at Clause 6. Clause 4 is about subrogation rights.
Yes, Your Honor.
Separate paragraph distinguishing subrogation rights from a direct cause of action.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're supposed to give effect to every paragraph of a statute if we can. Is it possible that subrogation rights are the topic of Clause 6? Because both refer to a primary plan. I'm just asking, what is the history of Clause 4 with respect to subrogation rights as opposed to the direct action that the government can bring against the primary insurer?
Your Honor, Clause 4 was added in an earlier iteration of the MSP Act in 1984. So, if I just to address your point, the statutes have been written always requiring the government to investigate and to move expeditiously. They're not even supposed to make a payment if there's a primary payer out there. But that's sentence one. That was 1980. In 1984, they added a clauses to the conditional payment sentence two, which is the government may pay even though there's a payment that has been made or could be made, then it's still a conditional payment. But that could be made all relates to the government moving expeditiously, and the subrogation clause was added in 1984. So it's a bit of a patchwork quilt, Your Honor. The Clause 6 wasn't added until 1997. I would submit, Your Honor, as to Clause 6, it doesn't say that it's just limited to subrogation.
No, it does not.
No.
It's not, but Clause 5 is on waiver, and I guess it applies to everything. Is that correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think all the clauses need to be read together and not in isolation, which is the proper principle of statutory construction. In Clause 6, I would contend, Your Honor, applies to the direct right of action by the government or a subrogation action by the government. And here, the appellant is arguing that in their briefs that we're not bound by Clause 6 at all because of, for example, the Tenet case, which they cited to as additional authority, which is really, forgive me, not applicable because Tenet was a very discrete, narrow issue of whether an MAO under the private cause of action can go after a medical provider versus a primary plan. The court said, no, you can't go after a medical provider, only a primary plan. That's what 3A says. But most importantly, the purpose of the and I wanted to add, I mentioned Judge King's interpretation of Clause 6. Counsel has also cited additional authority from Ohio in the case called Progressive, where the district court judge took issue with Judge King's assessment. He too found, he found, just like the magistrate in the court below, found that Clause 6 was permissive. And if you read Senior District Court Judge King's opinion, he really exposes the whole permissive aspect of this. And I would add that the Ohio District Court case cites to a case in Oklahoma. I would ask you to Your Honors, to please read these cases. The Ohio court cites a district court judge in Oklahoma in the Porter case, where the judge in Oklahoma said the government's reimbursement rights are automatic without the obligation to provide notice. And that judge in Oklahoma cites to the regulation 411.21. When you go to 411.21, those are just definitions. They say nothing about Clause 6. They don't even speak to the issue. So in other words, it's just basically the Oklahoma judge, without even citing Clause 6, dispenses with Clause 6 by citing two definitions that don't even address the issue.
Mr. Burdell, we've taken you way over your time, so we appreciate your patience with us. If you want to wrap up, you can.
I would contend, Your Honor, I haven't really gotten into the meat of my argument, which is that the statute has always been written requiring the government to act quickly and expeditiously or risk of waiver. And here what we have, and this is not the government coming in over 3 years after a request for payment could be made. It's not an MAO coming in. It's a purported assignee. The ship has sailed. The statutes can be read together. They have to comply with Clause 6, and if they do so, they've salvaged their right to bring a cause of action, and they haven't done so.
All right, Mr. Burdell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge Jordan, with respect to one of your questions as to when was the notice of responsibility here, and when is basically the last day that this case could have been brought? When was this timely or under BIII? Even if some of the facts that were brought out by the defendant were true, the bottom line is that the notice runs from the time of the demonstrated responsibility. There is no question that the underlying settlement was executed on March 28th of 2013. Certainly the plaintiff's assigner in the case could not have had notice of the actual demonstration of responsibility until the settlement had actually been entered into, at which point the defendant became a primary plan under the Act. And as a result, the case is timely, would at minimum be timely, provided it was filed prior to March 28th of 2016, which it absolutely was. With respect to your question, Judge Wright, regarding the history of the subrogation right at paragraph B4, the subrogation rights were enacted at the same time as the direct right of action, and have been interpreted since that time by the Secretary as well as the courts as being an entirely separate bundle of rights. This is what 2B provides. It provides a bundle of rights to the Medicare program in order to be able to effectuate recoveries while at the same time imposing affirmative obligations on the primary plans to comply with their obligations under the Act at risk of enforcement. As a result, Judge King erred when he announced this as a limitations period or the imposition of any sort of restriction on Medicare's right to recover. The appellee referenced the Shalala opinion. And it's important that this B6 grew out was enacted as a direct response to Shalala. In the Shalala opinion, the court at the D.C. Circuit ultimately went determined that a regulation enacted by the secretary had overstepped the rulemaking authority of the secretary by doing away or liberating a plan for the government from any claims filing provision. There had been a prior decision from the same court, from the D.C. Circuit in Sullivan, which is cited in our brief, in 1992, which said that in fact that regulation, the claims filing installation, was consistent with the overarching claims, with the overarching purpose of the statute, and as a result, a valid exercise of the secretary's authority. In 1992, when that opinion was issued, Congress certainly did not act in response. It was only in 1994 when the D.C. Circuit receded from its prior opinion and as a result imposed limitations by virtue of that decision upon Medicare and restricted its Medicare recovery rights that Congress sprung into action. And as a result, B-6 was enacted. B-6, thus, is not a limitations period, but it's another ascription of a right to Medicare in order to assist it in protecting the Medicare trust. That's what this is about. That's what the purpose of the statute is intended to achieve, and it's against the and that's the prism through which all of these provisions should be read. And in doing so, Congress clearly and unequivocally stated that this is intended that under the circumstances, Medicare is entitled to utilize its subrogation right, pursue claims against a group health plan, which often has very restrictive claims filing periods, and it can do so regardless of whether or not the underlying individual or beneficiary ever complied with those provisions. So Congress, it can bring its right, and it can bring that subrogation claim within 3 years of the date of the item or service. And the language of the statute is important. It references the request for payment. And the request for payment in this instance could certainly be a lawsuit under B3. There's nothing that prevents it. The language of the statute is clear in that respect. And in light of Shalala and the underlying history, it's important to put the claims filing provision in its proper context. On that point, there is a portion of the Congressional Budget Office report that's taken severely out of context in the briefing, and it has been pointed to by the defendants as an indication that Congress enacted the B-6 in order to safeguard the private insurers. And it plainly demonstrates, when read in full, that in fact there was no such intention. The intent of Congress was to expand the rights of Medicare, was to ensure that it had additional time to pursue these types of claims, and as a result of that additional time, determined that $0.4 billion over 5 years would hopefully be saved by the Medicare Trust. Certainly, it was not the intent to save less money by insulating private insurers by virtue of a claims filing requirement that would be very difficult to comply with. I do see that I'm over my time, but if the court would indulge me, I have just one last point. I don't think that it is substantively irrelevant that the plaintiff in this case is not the government. And the first point, the appellee's lead point, is indicative of the reason that underlies the statutory interpretation that they've advanced here. MAOs are entitled to pursue these sorts of recoveries. It is an aggregation, like what has been brought by MSP, that permits them to level the playing field and pursue recoveries that were always intended by Congress. Yes,
that's not really an argument in rebuttal, but one that you might have wanted to lead off with. So, but we thank you very much for your help. We really appreciate it. Court is in recess for the week.